Hey everybody, this is Shannon with VIP Kid World, and welcome back. In today's podcast, we're going to be moving on to the next chapter, chapter 7 of our book reading, Little Soldiers by Lenora Chu, and this chapter is aptly titled Little Soldiers. I hope you guys have been enjoying the book reading so far. I really appreciate everyone that's actually reached out to me either recently in a workshop or through social media to tell me that you're enjoying the book reading. Not a lot of feedback through these types of podcasts, but I really do appreciate you reaching out and letting me know that you're enjoying it. And I myself have also been enjoying getting an opportunity to look at this information once again. I do hope that it's helping you feel like a better VIP kid teacher, just like it does for me. As always, please forgive me for any pronunciation errors I make, and let's jump into chapter 7, Little Soldiers. The school curriculum is being used as a means of political indoctrination for the purpose of ruling the people rather than for the development of the individual person. Li Maosen, moral education scholar. One night, Rainey had an announcement for me. "I like China better than America," he said in his sing-songy voice. "What, Rainey?" I asked, startled. We had never really talked about the concept of country, nor had we ever discussed nationality or ethnicity. To explain, I would have had to say, "Rainey, my ancestors are from China, and your fathers are from Germany, Norway, and Sweden. Your father is as white as they come, but in an odd twist, he lived in China as a Peace Corps volunteer long before your mother ever stepped foot in her ancestral motherland. Racially, you're exactly half of each of your dad and mom, Caucasian and Chinese. But your nationality is American. Oh, and by the way, all of your classmates are Chinese nationals." It was complicated. I glanced over at Rainey and tendered a question. "Why do you like China better than America?" I asked. Was Rainey repeating something he'd heard at school? Had someone planted this idea in his head? And what about that time back in the States, under a classic barbecue and summer blue sky, when America had won? Rainey lifted his shoulders in a 4-year-old shrug. At the front of most classrooms in China sits a framed flag of the People's Republic of China. Bright red to signify the Communist Revolution, the Chinese flag boasts a large yellow star as stand-in for the Communist Party, and 4 smaller stars arranged in orbit, the people under its rule. The Chinese schoolroom flag is nothing like the American version, I remember. The stars and stripes hang from a pole within a child's reach, its fabric rippling whenever the classroom door sends a gust of air its way. You can touch it. Wipe your grape jam-smeared mouth on it. Not that your teacher would be happy about this. Or even burn it if you so desire, with your right to do so protected by the United States Constitution. By contrast, it's a crime to desecrate the Chinese flag, punishable by prison time. In the schoolroom, the Chinese flag is affixed behind a pane of glass, encased in wood, and hung high above the students' heads. A fitting metaphor for education in China. Always heed the higher authority. Mounted north of the chalkboard and hovering over every school teacher in China is this daily visual reminder of the true purpose of Chinese education. Chinese schools teach math and science, yes, but they are also charged with the singular objective, shaping students into proper citizens of their country. Much is required of the mind of a Chinese citizen. He must love country, China, his people, the Chinese, labor, working for China, scientific knowledge, the key to China's economic future, and socialism, the Chinese market model. These 5 loves are embedded in the national curriculum and appear in textbooks from primary school all the way through college, and they are the pillars of the party's campaign to shape the worldview of the people. It's patriotism as a governing technique, a practice as old as China's history itself. Indeed, you could say that China's leadership has had thousands of years of practice tightening its grip on the hearts and minds of its people. Confucius himself believed that government by ideology was more important and effective than government by law, wrote moral education scholar Li Maosen. Confucius said, "He who rules by moral force is like the pole star, which remains in its place while the other stars surround it." In other words, why use guns or force when leaders instead could cultivate an internal self-governing compass in every person under your rule? I thought again about those families who stared upward at the champion list. Years of back-breaking study were required to advance into the imperial court. Yong Zhao, a scholar famously disdainful of China's education system, said the exam system served a convenient purpose for the leaders who perpetuated it, keeping the best and brightest young men memorizing texts most hours of the day, their minds steeped in Confucian philosophy, which forbade them to have any unorthodox thoughts. Lots of time devoted to study meant little time to organize rebellions, making exams a handy tool for governing a large mass of land carved up into, at times, warring factions. The party's approach to education today is a little different. In 1949, the communists took the helm of a country ravaged by war, with vast gaps in welfare from village to village and region to region. It inherited a school system that was in tatters. Slotting patriotism into the school curriculum was a neat trick. It brought together a widely divergent population, since the schools the party was charged with uniting were disparate, as the work unit, schools of Mao's communism or communists, the institutions of the departed Kuomintang, and classrooms inside orphanages governed by provinces. In the early years of communist rule, school teachers were directly responsible for disseminating party policy. The first primary school textbook created under Mao sang the man's praises. "Chairman Mao is like the sun. He shines even brighter than the sun. We will follow you forever." A 1950s textbook passage reminded students whom to thank for progress. "My grandpa herded sheep when he was six. My father fled famine when he was six. This year I turned six, and I am in school due to the Communist Party's help." The state's propaganda department was nothing if not opportunistic, and it was bold with its machinations. Depending on the era, it tapped certain themes over others, including Marxism as dominant ideology, China's humiliation at the hands of Japanese aggressors, or the importance of a socialist market economy. In 2017, the party announced that all textbooks would be rewritten to move up the start of the Japanese war by 6 years. By lengthening the Sino-Japanese conflict to 14 years and pegging its start to Imperial Japan's 1931 invasion of Manchuria, the move was expected to incite patriotism, and even more wariness of the Japanese. Just like that, history was recast. As China opened up to the world, the party's target morphed, as if leaders suddenly realized it couldn't realistically cultivate 1 billion communists. Instead, they reasoned that a strong national identity would instill a loyalty to the homeland, as their people scattered across the globe for jobs and education. In this, there should be no limit. People shall be influenced and nurtured by the patriotic thoughts and spirit all times and everywhere in their daily life, stated the party's Central Committee in 1994. It was a grand ambition, and the party's hand reached down not only into the schoolroom, but also across film, television, and news media. Patriotism is thought to be the most effective weapon against the danger of losing Chinese identity and against all kinds of foreign invasions, political, military, economic, and cultural, writes Maosen. Of course, China isn't the first or even the most fervent nation to try to cultivate a population of patriots. Many American students sing the national anthem each day, and the 4th of July holiday celebrating U.S. independence from England is a national holiday of parades, barbecues, and flag-bearing patriots. In India, people must stand for the national anthem before watching a movie. Many cinemas in Thailand will show a video of their king prior to the main feature and require the audience to stand. Russian high school students must endure military training each year. Much like that, the People's Liberation Army, run equivalent, that is, required of Chinese schoolchildren of every stripe. Muse the academic Joel Westheimer, if you step into a school at a moment of patriotic expression, how could you tell whether you were in a totalitarian nation or a democratic one? Both a totalitarian nation and the democratic one might have students sing a national anthem. You might hear a hip hip hooray kind of cheer for our land emanating from the assembly hall of either school. Flags and symbols of national pride might be front and center in each school, and the students of each school might observe a moment of silence for members of their country's armed forces who had been killed in combat. Here's the distinction. China is singularly unapologetic and unabashed in deploying its education system as a governing technique. When the pro-democracy movement Occupy Central brought Hong Kong to a standstill for 79 days, officials in Beijing quickly assigned blame to the lack of patriotic education in the city's school curriculum. It is clear that there have been problems all along with the education in Hong Kong, said China's former deputy Hong Kong official Chen Zuo'er. Chen then prescribed a cure of national security and sovereignty to prevent the growth of noxious weeds, his terms for students who sat in peaceful protest. An agenda of preserving patriotism continues in college. China is one of the few countries in the world to deliver a political curriculum inside higher education, with content dictated by the Communist Party. To me, all this heavy-handedness seemed a bit out of touch with reality. As the Chinese had increasing access to information through the internet, not to mention counterintuitive. In particular, I wondered how China's leaders could cultivate critical thinking in education, one of many ongoing reform attempts, while also pushing a patriotic agenda. I turned to Beijing academic Xi Xiaoqing. Might the student begin to question certain elements of their education if they're encouraged to think too freely? Wouldn't the leadership consider this dangerous? I asked him. Xi insisted on speaking English, and he became loose-lipped while grandstanding in his second language. The top leaders hope to develop the students' critical thinking in the fields of physics, mathematics, chemistry, and biology, and so on, he admitted, but not in the fields of politics, ethics, and religion. Not in the fields of politics, ethics, and religion. That classroom flag defines the parameters for society. Change is fine, as long as those four yellow stars, the Chinese people, are always affixed in orbit around the large yellow star. For the most extraordinary students, official membership in the Communist Party awaits, and the long process of grooming begins early in a school child's career. So it began with Rainey and his classmates at Sun Qingling. I get to be Zhui Sheng, student on duty this week, Rainey told me one day, jumping around our living room. What does that mean, Rainey? I asked, wondering if this would launch his journey down the red road. I get to put rice in everybody's bowl at lunch, he said. I add water to the strawberry, bean, and carrot plants. I feed the class caterpillars. I also announce when kids can go outside and play after they finish their morning snack. Teachers began rotating children through this student-on-duty position in kindergarten. The purpose is threefold. Teachers get help with classroom tasks, students learn about service to their community, and classmates can take note of how well individual students help their peers. These notes on service are useful when elections for class monitor roll around. In primary, middle, and senior high school years, such positions come with power and opportunity, such as the duty of disciplining peers and working closely with school administrators. I'd always been uncomfortable with the idea that individual students, chosen ones, might have power over their classmates. But in kindergarten, such exercises begin innocently. Rainey's teachers ran mock elections for class monitor, and the first time he ran, our son was bested by his classmate, a chipper little girl named Lien Peng. Votes were tallied by body count, and Teacher Song sent by WeChat a picture of the girl's moment of victory. Rainey and Lien Peng standing side by side with a long line of classmates snaking behind each child. Finger tapping the screen, I counted heads. 10 children stood behind Rainey, and 13 trailed Lien Peng. Rainey had lost by 3. Undaunted, my little boy began immediately strategizing for his next campaign. Lien Peng had a good speech, Rainey chirped, matter-of-factly. Lien Peng said stuff that was longer and more better, and there was more stuff. A few election cycles later, Rainey won by 4. Mom, you want to hear my speech? He said, planting in front of our television, words tumbling out tentatively in Mandarin. Every time he forgot a line, he glanced upward as if expecting the words to rain out of his mouth. Dear teachers and classmates, I want to be your class monitor. I will serve everyone. If anyone bumps into difficulties, I'll help them solve the problem. If anyone gets hurt, I'll talk to the teacher for help. Please vote for me. Great speech, Rainey, I said. I guess that was enough stuff this time, right? Yes, he beamed. I said a lot of stuff. That week, his place in the pecking order was clear. Because I'm class monitor, I get to tell the student on duty what to do, Rainey told me. He brandished a badge he'd attached to his shirt and high-stepped around our living room to a tune I couldn't hear. Did President Xi Jinping do the same as a youngster? It's just play-acting, I tried to assure myself. Where I was troubled, Teacher Song was thrilled. The children work seriously and efficiently, and when they manage order in the classroom as student on duty, they become little teachers, she effused in the child development book. In this way, the activity can not only correct children's bad behaviors in the early age, but also enhance their sense of serving others in the classroom. That's really killing two birds with one stone. The cultivation continues in primary school, where all children are encouraged to join Young Pioneers, whose mission statement includes following the instructions of the party, being successors to the cause of communism. At 14, things start to get serious, and students with the blessing of two league memberships or members can apply to the Communist Youth League, akin to a school for young people to learn about socialism with Chinese characteristics and about communism, and to serve as a helper and reserve member for the party, as its constitution states. Both Premier Li Keqiang and former President Hu Jintao rose through the ranks of the Communist Youth League. Today, there are nearly 90 million members of the Communist Youth League in China, and another 89 million in the party proper. Darcy, my young high school friend in Shanghai, planned to join the party by his 18th birthday. At 17, Darcy was already one of the chosen ones. I am Gigi Fengji, and my plan is working, he told me, using a term that meant zealot or enthusiast, and is also a status designated by the party. By his junior year in high school, teachers in his grade had vouched for him, and he was chosen to start the process. It had already been given initiation rites, attended special classes, and written reports praising the party. It was an invitation bestowed upon only 300 or 400 students in his grade level. He showed me a letter he'd penned as a part of the application. The title was Walking on the Red Road. They are brave, regardless of war or disaster. They always run ahead, throwing your head to shed blood. They are wise, with far-sighted leadership of a new China. They are walking on the Red Road people. They are communists. Darcy's list of accomplishments revealed a distinguished young pioneer with the right kind of grooming to serve in the League. Disciplinary board member, discipline inspector, vice squad leader, and the boy concluded that he would work to secure the long future of the Communist Party. I set foot on the Red Road, in the front of the older generations of revolutionaries, and we will try to catch up, take the stick in their hands, overcome all obstacles so that the Red Road is wider and longer. I gazed at that baby-faced teen who sipped coffee before me. He wore an Adidas tracksuit and Nike cross trainers, apparently the costume of today's budding communist leader. "Do you believe everything you wrote here?" I asked Darcy, fingering the paper. Darcy paused. "Yes, I believe," he said and nodded, wall of bangs moving with his head. As we became better acquainted, Darcy's House of Communists crumbled under scrutiny. Much of what I've written is official guangfang, gobbledygook, Darcy told me once in a whisper. "Just stuff I have to do," he said. "It's what you need to do to get ahead." His ultimate goal was outside the reach of the party and off the trail of the Red Road. Graduate school at the University of Michigan. "You want to study abroad?" I asked him. "Yes," he said and nodded, as a worrisome thought suddenly entered his brain. "If I want to study in America, will they care if I'm a communist?" he asked, head bowed but eyes fixed on mine, waiting for an answer. I realized that the face my friend presented to the world flipped and flopped depending on the audience and purpose at hand. But one thing was clear. As an ambitious child of migrants, Darcy would join the party because it ensured a brighter future inside Chinese borders. Membership opened up a new world of perks. Eligibility for scholarships, the networks to find good jobs, positions at state-owned enterprises. Party membership is required for promotion in many government and university jobs. Darcy was among China's best and brightest, and these were things he simply had to do. As I pondered the futures of my two Chinese student friends, I realized they were set for sharply divergent paths. Whereas Amanda's year abroad would pave the way for college overseas, Darcy must navigate Chinese society the best he could. When I thought about Darcy's situation, I realized most Chinese present public faces that are very different from their private thoughts. To me, this state of affairs seemed particularly problematic for China's youngest generation. As an American, the self I offered to the outside world and the one I paraded around in the privacy of my apartment were mostly one and the same. Sure, a fully functioning member of society must follow its spoken and unspoken rules, but for the most part, I could offer any thought I wanted for all to see. Darcy didn't have that luxury. When I looked a little deeper into the issue, I discovered I wasn't the only one who was worried. A handful of brave Chinese scholars criticized China's moral education curriculum for this very reason, assigning the party's heavy hand a losing proposition and a failing letter grade. Here's the problem. A huge gap exists between the kids that are taught in school, government provides for you, and what they see happening in real life, government officials taking privileges for themselves. There's an immense gulf between what people say they believe, long live the communists, and what desires they harbor in their personal lives. Capitalism affords me opportunity and a decent pair of Nikes. China's speeding economic change has shaken the socialist values upon which the party was founded. Capitalism abounds, and spending hours in the classroom trying to convince students otherwise has become unconvincing and unreliable in many respects, writes the moral education scholar Li Maosen. The party's attempts at moral education have simply become a means of political indoctrination for the purpose of ruling the people rather than for the development of the individual person. The public intellectual Ran Yufei derides a society where the educational materials are all about loving the party. Of course, it leads to a spiritual crisis, he told the New York Review of Books. China is growing a nation of patriots who worship the party in public but cultivate alternative thoughts in private. Take the models that the Communist Party put forth as heroes. Darcy and Amanda, having gone through nearly two decades of public Chinese education, could rattle off their names and stories without pause. Lai Ning was a 14-year-old student who perished while assisting firefighters in tackling a blaze in Sichuan province. He was remembered as a standoffish yet studious boy, but after his death, the state declared him a selfless national hero. Huang Jingwang used his own body to block enemy bullets while struggling bravely for the Chinese during the Korean War. Soldier Dong Kung-ri fought for the communists in 1948, and he detonated explosives to clear a bunker. "For a new China," he yelled, as the story goes, just before sacrificing himself with the act. Disseminated through the curriculum and presented in class, these models are almost always People's Liberation Army soldiers or devotees who exhibited extraordinary devotion to Mao Zedong, party elders, or the greater good. Most Chinese today believe their stories are out of touch with reality, and it's no surprise that any tale encouraging a generation of precious only children to sacrifice, to self-sacrifice, might not sit very well with parents. In private, families have their own interpretations. A girlfriend put her two girls in public school in Guangdong. One week, the young students were told the story of a man who carried a Chinese flag with pride, but who was also slowly starving to death in the hot sun. One day, he encountered a potential savior, a passerby with a loaf of bread. "I'll trade you this loaf of bread for that flag," the passerby said. "No," replied the starving flag bearer, despite the hunger in his stomach and the weakness in his limbs. "How about 10 loaves of bread for the flag?" "Still, no," said the flag bearer. As the story goes, the man died of starvation, holding the flag upright as long as he could bear it. The teacher would then echo the moral of the story. "How brave that man was." My friend was horrified. "I try to combat the brainwashing at home," she told me. "I teach my kids to take the bread. Right, girls?" she said, looking over at them during brunch at our home. "What do we choose instead of the flag?" "The bread," both girls, ages 6 and 9, answered in unison. The tension between ideology and reality was on full display when I visited a high school political science class, curious to understand whether Chinese students recognize the party's effort to indoctrinate them. "You are the future owners of this country," Dr. Chu told her 32 Shanghai high school students. "You are the future of the motherland and our hope. If you travel down the wrong path, you all lead our country to nowhere." I'd slipped into the classroom and sat at the back, invited to observe by the principal, who was acquainted with my research assistant. The students were parked in pairs at metal desks, which were in turn grouped into three columns, running from the chalkboard to the back of the room. I'd always been struck by the inside of the Chinese classroom. Daylight glaring through a single-pane window, lone circular fan descending from a high plaster ceiling, green chalkboard cleaned by students during break, the etchings of the previous day's instructions still faintly detectable. It felt more like a barracks than a classroom. Mounted on the front wall was the Chinese flag, and the students sat attentively. "Now, let's talk about the civil service exam," Teacher Chi said, Please speak your thoughts. Why do thousands of people try to get onto that boat of civil service jobs? Because civil service jobs are an iron bowl, a secured job. A gold bowl, another student exclaimed. A super secured job. Money, chimed in one student, a shudder passing through her shoulders. It was wintertime. The students wore heavy red and gray coats over their uniforms. Public schools don't usually have heat, and shivered over textbooks. Not much money, but good stability, good welfare, another echoed. Another boy chimed in, his voice low and husky. They can also embezzle. Embezzlement, Teacher Chi repeated, echoing my surprise. In recent years, foreign investigative journalists had uncovered billions of assets sitting in accounts and shell companies held by family members of sitting communist leaders. It was money derived from business contacts resulting directly from a connection to power. This was an open secret, but I hadn't expected students to feel comfortable openly questioning party leaders in a classroom. Teacher Chi looked at the boy, who rephrased, to put it more mildly, to earn extra money, he said. Don't babble, Chi admonished, nodding toward me, where I sat in the back of the room. You are embarrassed. You are embarrassing the teacher, who is sitting in the class. It was a gentle reminder that outsiders sat in the room. Don't pull back that curtain too far. The teacher tried to redirect. Public servants are just like us. Anyone can take the exam and become a public servant, fulfill their obligations, and enjoy the security provided by the state. They are not to be envied. To be quite honest, I wasn't sure who was more skeptical of her statement, the teacher or the students. Chinese society has become a brutal dog-eat-dog environment where everyone is obsessed with getting ahead. In such a competitive environment, a lecture about serving the state rings hollow. A different student spoke. Public servants, he announced, become the privileged class, which contradicts their role as people's servants. The boy was right to criticize. A financial and ethical morass, assisted by a lack of transparency or due process in government, had cast a shadow on China's government dealings at nearly every level. The Western equivalent of the Chinese central government corruption recently uncovered might be a skyscraper sitting in the name of the UK prime minister's cousin, or the discovery of a US president's mother owned stakes in insurance companies worth $800 million. Despite the fact that neither the cousin nor the mother worked in real estate or insurance. When this happened in China, the people have no recourse. The teacher challenged a student. Most public servants have no privileges. Most adhere to proper procedure, in proper order. For example, when we get up in the morning, we must first wash our face, and then brush our teeth, and then we can go eat breakfast. But some eat breakfast first, another student chimed in. I imagine this was his euphemism for officials who embezzle public funds or leverage power inappropriately. Sure, some eat breakfast first, Teacher Chu said, trying to steer the conversation back on track. Then they wash their face and brush their teeth. Your example is not appropriate, the student countered. Do you have other examples? The teacher asked, glancing my way. What kind of behavior requires a certain order? For instance, handing in homework. Assembly lines in a capitalist society, the student responded. This was also a challenge. Capitalism is a no-no. The official party line for China's system is socialism with Chinese characteristics. What kind of assembly line? In what kind of order? Teacher Chu posed, working again to redirect. The student responded with a chant. Long live communism and long live the Communist Party, he chortled, and the whole class laughed. You shout out a slogan, Teacher Chu said. The student offered another one, the sarcasm drowning his voice. This time, he used the slang for President Xi Jinping. Xi Dada is a good person. In private, Teacher Chu spoke of a simpler time, hands folded in her lap. Public servants used to aspire the admiration of students, she told me. Class dismissed, the nostalgia of another era softening her voice. This admiration was unequivocal. Today, students challenge the notion that domestic shame should be kept hidden. And China's leadership prefers domestic shame buried under 10 feet of Yuanese soil, preferably frozen solid to deter ice picks and shovels. Civil servants, such as Teacher Chu, are expected to be infantrymen in the effort to keep the populace in line. Chi longed for another era, but a lanky, charismatic history teacher I met in Beijing was more than content to sweep burgeoning sentiments of dissent under a rug. Teacher Kang never questioned the boundaries of what can be discussed in the classroom. Every Chinese knows what can be said in class and what cannot, Kang boomed. I'd met him at an educational conference in Beijing, and he agreed to talk with me about moral education. We bantered for about an hour about theories of civil education before he began to open up. Is there an instruction manual to what can't be said? I said, Teacher Kang, half-joking. There's nothing clearly written, Kang responded, although a 2013 central government document was explicit. It banned discussion of democracy, freedom of speech, and past mistakes of the Communist Party. Then how do you know? I asked. I just know it, Kang continued, matter-of-factly. Nothing is Mingguan, explicitly stated. I pressed. What can't you say in class? Kang rattled off a list. You should not mention Falun Gong. You should especially not mention Falun Gong. That's more sensitive than June 4th incident. Also, the Islam problem. Falun Gong is a Buddhist spiritual practice deemed a threat to social stability, and the June 4th incident is shorthand for June 4th, 1989, Tiananmen Square Massacre, in which Beijing sent tens of thousands of troops to crack down on a student pro-democracy demonstration. The Islam problem refers to Muslim separatists in Xinjiang and their perceived threat to the Chinese Han majority ethnic group. Is it possible to criticize the government? I asked Kang. Kang thought for a little bit. I can't give you a simple yes or no answer. It depends. You can discuss a specific problem of the government, such as Beijing's terrible urban planning, our traffic jams, and awful public service. What about corruption? Corruption can be discussed. This is no problem, Kang affirmed. Are you sure? I said. This was surprising to me, but it explained what I saw in that political class. Kang clarified. You cannot challenge the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. This you should avoid. But you can discuss the causation of corruption. For example, the lack of checks and balances of power. How do you know where the line is drawn? At this, he laughed heartily, his head jolting to the right. I am Chinese, I know. History tells you this. The Cultural Revolution was a dark time, and China learned its lesson. This was Mao Zedong's ill-fated attempt to purge capitalism and traditional thought from Chinese society and to reinstall Maoism as a central philosophy. A campaign that resulted in the persecution of millions. A Harvard-based researcher backed up Kang's assertion about speech. Gary King analyzed nearly 11 million social media posts and found that it's a call to action rather than language that Beijing is most interested in suppressing. Words alone are permitted, no matter how critical or vitriolic. The researchers wrote. But mere mentions of collective action or of any large gathering not sponsored by the state, whether peaceful or in protest, are censored immediately. Recently, President Xi Jinping has tightened his grip on academic freedom, an action one scholar likened to a minor cultural revolution, and also tapered the channels that bring content of Western curricula into China at all levels of schooling. I asked Teacher Kang about the party's increasingly heavy hand. Setbacks are inevitable, he admitted. But he also said that an authoritarian government is necessary for China in this stage of development. A civil society hasn't yet formed. It's not rational to build a democracy for China simply because a democracy is more advanced. My Chinese student, Darcy, in fact, my student friend, believed a two-party system was patently inefficient. With one party, policies can be implemented, he said with a firm nod. In America, if Democrats want to ban guns, the whole nation would ban guns. But because Republicans object, it's hard to enforce. In China, there's only one party. They can do what they want immediately. During other conversations, Darcy had hinted at differences between his public and private faces, but on the benefits of a one-party system, he seemed patently certain. Amanda had a similarly practical approach. As a lead student organizer for a Model United Nations conference in China, she'd been told certain topics could not be discussed. Taiwan and Tibet, the election in Hong Kong, race in South Africa, and the conflict between Iran and Israel, our director tells us we can't talk about. I was flabbergasted. I expected outrage, or at least a little bit of displeasure at the fact that Amanda was told she couldn't discuss. So, the purpose of the Model UN is encouraging free thinking among the next generation of leaders? I challenged her. You're telling me that outright censorship and debate of topics inside an event whose purpose is to debate world events? Amanda shrugged me off. We can't afford to care about censorship. That's a Western luxury. You forget that China is still a developing country, and we are still focusing on making sure we have food, housing, and education. As she saw the incredulity growing in my eyes, Amanda put me in check with an observation gleaned from her year in the United States. Americans have this illusion of freedom and democracy, she told me, but it was the Founding Fathers who created the Constitution, an elite group controlled by a minority. Good point. America is not truly a democracy. It's elitism, she declared. By telling people it's a democracy, it gives people an illusion that there's hope. That the difference between Chinese and Americans, the Chinese are devoid of real hope. So they just concentrate on their personal issues. With that, she looked down into her coffee resolutely. Our discussion was finished. One week, I caught Rainey singing, I'm a little soldier, I practice every day, in Mandarin, while marching down the hallway. His arms swung to and fro as his knees lifted to the ceiling. I take a wooden gun, bang, bang, bang. I drive a small gunboat, boom, boom, boom. At the word gun, Rainey clicked left hand to right elbow and crouched forward. His right hand made the shape of a gun, as if he were an infantryman on the lookout for enemy fire. I ride as a cavalryman, go, go, go. I am a little soldier, I practice every day. One, two, one, two, one, two, one. Let us march forward. Forward march. That was wonderful, Rainey, I called after his retreating backside. I blinked hard as he marched into his room. Earlier in this year, he'd also trumpeted the lyrics of The East is Red. The East is red, the sun is rising. From China comes Mao Zedong. He strives for the people's happiness. Hurrah! He is the people's great savior. At the time, I polled American and European friends whose kids were also in local Chinese schools. Then they seemed to fall into two camps. They were either repulsed or they shrugged it off. What do you expect? It's a Chinese school, My German friend Chris had teased me before zooming off on his scooter, heading to work. The following week, as Rainey and I headed out the door for school, I glanced down to see my son clutching a thin black trash bag that he had salvaged from underneath the kitchen sink. "What's that trash bag for?" I asked him.
"It's for trash," he told me.
He skipped ahead of me on the walk to Sun Qingling, and I watched as he stooped to collect trash inside the grounds of our apartment complex. He rooted around in the leaves to find snap, twigs, a pebble, and a discarded lollipop wrapper. He inserted each into the plastic bag, gripped it in his left hand. On the street, the trash got sinister. He spotted a broken glass medicine bottle, the type that awaits a syringe. It appeared to be used as a vial of diabetes medication.
I'll take that one," I said, swooping it up out of his reach. I inserted it into the bag.
In that moment, he spotted a crumpled tissue, which he coaxed into his bag.
"Rainey, can we please stop? What are you doing?"
"I am making China beautiful," he responded.
"Why are you making China beautiful, Rainey? Who told you about that?"
"The teachers."
At various moments on the walk to school, Rainey bent and stooped and spotted more treasures for his trash bag. As we approached Sun Qingling, Iron Gates, a grandmother saw Rainey's bag, and as many Chinese often do, she spotted a teaching moment for her progeny. She rapped her grandson on the back of the head. Thwap!
"Look at him! He is collecting trash! He is Hao Haizi, a good kid," she said. "You're a bad kid. You don't pick up trash."
She delivered a firm push on his shoulder, and the child lurched forward. Before we reached the classroom, Rainey handed me the bag. I peered in and saw a montage of china. The old and the new, the used and the discarded. A peanut, dirty leaves, a dried lotus flower, an ice cream wrapper, the gold foil of a Ferrero Rocher chocolate, the glass medicine bottle, which had the characters for insulin. We arrived at the classroom, and I told Teacher Song about Rainey's China beautification campaign. She beamed and patted him on the head.
"Rainey, why don't you put this in the trash can now?"
Later, I dialed Rob. "Our oldest son is morphing into a worker for the state," I panted into the phone as a group of slogans Amanda learned during her days in school days echoed in my head. "Labor is the most glorious thing. Sacrifice unselfishly for others. Serve your country, serve society. The interest of the people is higher than all else."
"That's ridiculous," Rob told me. "It's good that Rainey picked up trash."
"Yes, of course it's good," I told Rob, "but I feel like we're losing control of his mind. The school's becoming too powerful." Whether my son might eventually want to join the Communist Youth League wasn't a concern of mine. "Until now." Rob laughed. "Don't worry about it," he said. "He has us at home." I broached the topic with Darcy, who also shrugged off my worries.
"China would never truly be united front of patriots," Darcy said, voice low in an unguarded moment. "Nationalism is all in the memory. It's all in theory," he said. "In real life, human nature makes people consider themselves."
Amanda's conviction was even firmer. "The curriculum is all bullshit. Brainwashing. On the surface, teachers praise socialism. The party members need to write reports, but everyone knows the socialist economy. It's obvious. It's obvious to everyone." "School may have a student's attention for the moment, but try as it may, it's clear that the powers that cannot control context. Critical thought, or anything that proliferates inside the privacy of one's own head. China may conceive of a nation of patriots, and inside a child's educational journey, there may be times that towing the party line may seem expedient or even necessary. But the Chinese I knew recognized the party's blatant attempts to censor and control access to information, and ultimately, Amanda, Darcy,
and the moral education scholars were convinced that we had nothing to worry about. China's grip on the hearts and minds of its people would only grow more tenuous. The following week, Rainey was drawn over by the window working with blue and gold markers. I peeked over his shoulder. He was sketching what looked like a majestic tiered monument. Several dozen police figures dotted squares, drawn with ovals for heads atop squatty bodies, with a thin, scrawny line for arms and legs. A squarish military hat sat atop each oval. "What is this, Rainey?" I said, sweeping my hand over the drawing.
"You don't know Tiananmen?"
he said to me, his voice full of surprise. I looked at the picture. In the middle of the building, he'd placed the portrait of a man with no hair, an oval for a face, two dotted eyes, and a mouth upturned at the edges.
"Who's that?"
I asked, pointing to the man, though I already knew the answer.
"That's Mao,"
Rainey said. When most Westerners hear that word, Tiananmen, they think of 1989, the lone tank man, a student democracy movement, and the brutal government-sanctioned massacre of protesters in the square. Not my 4-year-old boy. To Rainey, Mao Zedong was a smiling egghead, and the square a monument to Chinese excellence.
"What did the teachers tell you about Tiananmen, Rainey?" "It's a place in Beijing," he said.
"What else?" I asked. But Rainey had exhausted his memory on the topic. Of course, the teacher had said nothing of its importance in the world history as the site of a democratic movement or a subsequent brutal massacre. It was an event that drew the world's scrutiny on Chinese human rights, and the student demonstration might have changed history by instigating a rebellion against the party in power. But the teachers wouldn't have said that. No teacher in China dared to discuss it. And, in fact, they couldn't even refer to the event by its proper month, day, and year. Instead, Rainey's teacher might have mentioned the square as a monument to Mao Zedong, or its representation of civic duties, country, people, labor, science, and socialism. As I glanced down at my son's drawing, I instinctively felt that whatever Beijing's desire to reform education, its basic purpose wouldn't alter course for years, if not decades. The preservation, the legitimacy of the Communist Party depended on it. I peered closer to examine my son's paper policeman and noticed a stark, dark shape in the place of some of the officer's hands. Rainey had drawn half of the stick figures with guns in hand. And that's the end of chapter 7 of our book reading. Hopefully you enjoyed this chapter. In the next podcast, we will move on to chapter 8, which is entitled 100 Days Till Test Time. Thank you all for listening. I appreciate your support, and I'll see you next time.